Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Diva Behavior, the podcast. I am your host, Molly Malshine, as always. And this week, we are doing something that we very rarely do. We're talking about a straight male diva. We're talking about Axl Rose, the lead singer of Guns N' Roses and the only remaining member of Guns N' Roses after he decided to kick his entire band out of the band and replace them with total randos. Axl Rose, you know, because he's a man, he's never been called a diva, but the things that he's done, if a woman did them, not only would she be called a diva, she would probably be absolutely, you know, crucified by the press and the general public. And Axl Rose did deal with a lot of bad press, but I don't think it was anything on the level of what a woman would have to deal with if she kept crowds waiting for 2 hours before performing, for example, or if a woman kicked out her entire band and proclaimed that she was now the band. I don't think women usually get away with that in the same way that he has. And the story of Axl Rose, you know, it's not all fun and games. There's a lot of really depressing parts. There's a lot of really problematic parts. I mean, I haven't felt this level of antipathy toward a diva behavior topic since maybe Sarah Ferguson, which is saying a lot. But it's an interesting conversation nonetheless. I mean, partially because of the timing. We get into it in the episode, but Axl Rose and Donald Trump have a lot in common. Interestingly enough, I think right now is as good a time as any. I mean, it's always a good time to talk about toxic masculinity. I think this past week, it's been even more top of mind than usual, which is saying something because it's been pretty top of mind for the past 4 years. And it's also an interesting conversation because of my guest. My guest this week is Matt Haas. He is a comedian and a music enthusiast. He has his own podcast called Castival, where he invites guests to cast their own dream version of a music festival, like come up with your dream lineup and everything. And I've been trying to think of what mine would be, and I honestly have no idea. Like, how do you even start? I know that Cher and Barbara Streisand would probably do a duet, but that's as far as I've gotten. So follow Matt Haas on all social platforms. His last name is H-O-S-S. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Molly Malshine. Rate and review this podcast. Send it to someone who you think would like it. You know, go crazy and enjoy us talking about Axl Rose.
Some people think diva is
a diva to you. Would you say, are you one?
I never said that.
Diva behavior.
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Of course, I don't trust you.
Diva Behavior, the podcast. Well, Matt, let's get to it. What made you want to talk about Axl Rose, this curveball guest that I never would have thought of in a million years? I mean, not guest, you know what I mean? You're the guest, but...
Well, I just, you know, with Axl Rose, I was asked to do this podcast, and I was asked about divas, and the first diva that popped in my head, and I love rock, I really love metal. I spent my whole teenage years being surrounded by rock and the ideas of lots of metal festivals like Download and Sonosphere. I grew up around them, and that was my tribe at that time. And the first person that came to my mind out of many, many candidates and was Axl Rose. And I think Axl Rose, I've loved Guns N' Roses for such a long time. I got to see them, the reunited group in 2018 at Download, which is phenomenal. But I think Axl Rose is such a unique and interesting person because he's both, like, I think he's quite disastrous. He's quite horrible, but also he has some redemptive features as well. I'm sure we'll talk about all of it. But I think he's such an interesting person. And in terms of a diva, he really ticks all the boxes as well. So I think he's an interesting one. A curveball, as you say, but I think it's a one definitely worth talking about. For sure.
He really does tick all the diva boxes. I didn't know any of this stuff until I started researching for this episode. He would keep his audiences waiting for up to 2 hours.
Oh my God.
Arena shows. This wasn't like a club show. He went into seclusion for about 10 years trying to work on an album. He decided that Guns N' Roses was going to be his band from now on, and no one else had a claim to it, even though they all started it together. He really is, if he was a woman, he would be considered diva of the century. Because he is a male rock star, it's just like, well, he's a rock star.
And I couldn't agree more. And I think he doesn't get labeled as a diva necessarily, but he definitely is a diva. I'm not sure if you have a diva tick box you have to go off, like a diva detection program, but I do feel that Axel ticks all the boxes. And if anyone's wants to research it, the amount of crazy things, just type in Axl Rose worst moments, and there's so many. I love doing research for this podcast, because I literally have 9 pages of just atrocities. And the worst thing is Axl Rose with cornrows, the worst thing in the world.
Oh yeah, I know. So when you were growing up with his music, were you aware of the sort of darker sides of him?
So I think this is a really good question. And I think when you're a teenager, you don't quite get to see the full remit of people. Obviously with some people you do, but I also think it's a really good conversation about toxic masculinity, because I feel that Guns N' Roses, my favorite album, and probably the best debut album of all time, is Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses.
It's bop after bop.
Yeah, absolutely. But when I listened to it as a teenager, I must have been about 13, and I remember listening to it in my brother's bedroom, because he had a CD player in there, and there's a song called After Sweet Child of Mine called You're Crazy, and I loved it because it had a curse word in it. It goes, you're so crazy, and I thought, oh, cool. But looking back at that, and especially doing research for this, it's kind of dulled my love of Guns N' Roses, because there's a lot of things wrong with it as well. And not just small things, there are some major problematic things in their music, which I wasn't aware of as a growing up, but it's also quite hard because I've loved them for so long that it's quite difficult to detach the love from it as well. It's like learning like one of your friends is really like a massive bigot, if you know what I mean. It's like, oh, I didn't expect it. But in the same vein, you're not surprised, because all the things that you've liked about them when you were younger kind of points to reasons why I liked it, because they had that look, like that amazing harsh sound, and I thought, but also in the same time that it came from a quite a dark place, I guess.
Right. So I think something really interesting to look at is on the topic of vulgarity and profanity in their music is the way that the different band members have reacted in recent years to their song One in a Million.
Yes.
And that song had every racial slur, homophobic epithet. It was just like terrible. And obviously, we're all for free expression. We're both stand-up comics. But this, when they talk about this song now, Slash and Duff McKagan both have said, we didn't mean it. We were telling it from the perspective of a racist, terrible person. Also, Slash is biracial. He has his, one of his parents is black. And then Axl Rose defends it by saying, well, I've met a lot of gay people that I didn't like gayness on me. And it's like, okay, you guys need to get your story straight, because it's just like, I don't know. And they did take it off of their 2018 box set, which I think is great, because Like, they are so rock and roll. And even they said, you know what? There's no need for this. We don't need to put the song out. And apparently, Axl was the only one who really wanted to put it out. The other guys never were crazy about it. So did you hear that song when you were younger?
Well, actually, I didn't hear that song because it was on... Yeah, One in a Million is really, it's an odd track because it's the last song of the second album, GNR Lies, which it's like, it was a weird album even for Guns N' Roses because it's an acoustic album. It felt quite out of place. It's a very odd second album to have because I had some covers from the first one and a lot of new stuff. And then they had this thing at the end. And yeah, as you mentioned, it's like, it's a really horrendous song and probably the worst thing which Axl probably has done, I would say. But beyond that, though, I kind of feel like if fair play to it, if you're going to be racist, it ticks all the bigot boxes, though. It's like, it doesn't just do one bigot thing. It does everything. Right.
Like Duff and Slash's explanation for it is plausible because it's so over the top terrible that you're like, yeah, this can't just be someone's perspective in real life.
But also, I don't think it's... I think it's born out of them... I think, actually, I don't know, I think at the time, Guns N' Roses were... I remember reading an article a long time ago in Classic Rock magazine. It's an article with Slash and the rest of the band members about how they made Appetite for Destruction. And they were like, there's like, it's like I was going to say One in a Million, but not that one kind of One in a Million. But it's a very small chance that the band actually made it because the amount of hard drugs they were doing. And I'm not meaning like they did a little bit of so-and-so. They did everything every single day. It was messy. It was gross. The kind of things they got up to were really deranged and quite disturbing, actually, and that's how they made a lot of the music. So the fact they managed to A, put together an album, B, make it sound good, and then do world tours off that, I can understand why. I don't defend their behavior, but I can see why they are doing problematic stuff because their heads aren't in the right space. You know what I mean? Right. They are, but that's again not an excuse, and also it kind of makes sense that One in a Million is kind of weird for that way because it's weird because it starts off as like a love song saying, oh yeah, you're one in a million, and then it just slips into this kind of racist and homophobic tirade. It's like, I'm not sure, like, where did that come from? It's kind of like, it's like going for Christmas dinner around your like parents, family, and then you have a nice chat, and then, oh, there's the racism. You know what I mean? Like, it just drops in very slowly, and it's really odd.
I think maybe part of what that was born out of might have been a reaction to, you know, in the 80s, in the late 80s, Nancy Reagan was doing her whole censorship of music thing. So I think a lot of musicians were wanting to just take things as far as humanly possible, just as a reaction to that, which obviously is not an excuse, but it sort of explains why they would let that terrible song slip through. And then the other thing is, in researching Axl Rose, I found that everyone says he's a really complex person. The thing that pops up again and again is that he has this chip on his shoulder. And I think that so let's talk about his childhood, his upbringing. He was raised by a man who was not his real father. He found out who his father was later in his life. His birth father was a really terrible guy. He, you know, got up to all kinds of bad stuff. And Axl later went into regressed memory therapy, which is where you recover memories. It's very controversial. You recover memories that you've been repressing. Mm-hmm. And people say that a lot of the time those memories aren't real. It was a big thing in the late 80s, early 90s, and no one really does it anymore. And he recovered a memory that his father had sexually abused him. Mm-hmm. And I feel like with One in a Million, with the fact that he's been accused of domestic abuse by two women, I feel like he often turns it back on how much of a victim he is. And that's what makes him so not a sympathetic character for me, because I'm just like, okay, you were sued for domestic abuse by these two women, and now magically you remember that you were also abused. And when he was talking about the racism in that song and the homophobia in that song, he's like, well, I'm a victim of the people that I'm talking about. Like, oh my God, dude, get your head out of your but.
Well, yeah, I think that's a really good way to frame it, to be fair. And I think that, I think that he does have a quite an angle to be like, but what, aren't I the one who should be? And that's what the kind of song is all about, really. It's been like, well, hey, as a white man, I've really got the short straw around here. You know what I mean? It's like,
yes.
I'm not sure about his past, and the way that you phrased it, it does sound like, to be fair, I'm quite naive, and I'm one of these people that kind of takes people at face value. But as soon as you said that, that makes total a lot more sense. But you know, maybe I work for a mental health charity in my day job, but like what I do see a lot with people is that the trauma they had in their upbringing, they do have in their later on in life, so they kind of repeat it, if not the mm-hmm. cycle of abuse repeats. And it might not be an excuse per se, but it might be the reason for that as well. And and from my experience, not personal experience, but from working with lots of people, like this, if you're doing really hard drugs like they were, there's probably a reason for it. No one does like class A drugs or very, very hard narcotics for a laugh. Do you know what I mean? It's there because it's born out of something. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think I had no idea you worked for a mental health charity. So this is even better that we're talking about this. So what do you think would be the path forward for Axl Rose if he was to try and pursue any sort of redemption? Because I think what his narrative has been so far, since sort of the darker parts of him became more public, he's been really into homeopathic remedies and seeing therapists out in Arizona and things like that. So it seems like he is trying to work on himself. This is something we've also seen with Shia LaBeouf recently, saying, you know, I am being accused of abusing people. I was abused myself. So like you said, it is an explanation for that sort of behavior, but what's the atonement need to look like? Obviously we're not going to solve this problem, but I would just love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. And I think I think he's definitely started that path. And I think that path started by dusting that chip off his shoulder and going back to the band and reuniting with Guns N' Roses. I actually think that did a lot of good for him. And also working, he covered for AC/DC and vocals for a bit as well. And I think it's not exactly a cure-all, but like what happened there is that, as you mentioned at the very start, he's late to every single show, but for AC/DC, they're like, nope, you got to cut out that crap. And it felt like a bit like a training school for him as well. He had training wheels on for a bit. And I think he's on that path. As of recently, I know he's been very vocal against Donald Trump, which I think he's slowly kind of coming back. He's coming back on track. Do you know what I mean? He's using his voice for a better good. He still kind of puts his foot in it, and I think he's trying to be better. And I do think it just requires him more to kind of just take stock on his life. And hopefully, you know, maybe I would love to see a new album from Guns N' Roses where it's their sound, but maybe kind of going back. And kind of righting the wrong, so to speak. And I think that's a good thing to do. For example, one of my favorite songs by Beastie Boys. And Beastie Boys, in their first couple of albums, they were quite misogynistic and quite abusive in their lyrics as well. And when they started off as a parody band where they were just kind of just being like, they were saying nonsense because it fit the character, but then they became the character, and it was and they had to live by the words that they said, and it became very male centric and quite grim. But then on their fourth album, on the first song of that album, it's called Chew a Shot, and they have a whole stanza about just kind of like, you know what, we've said some terrible things in the past, we're really sorry, we're not just b-boys, we're b-girls as well, we're all here as a team. And you can rewrite the past, those two stories can co-align. And but what needs to happen is to say, okay, that was me in the past, I appreciate the music I did then, but also, you know, I've grown. You need to show growth, you know what I mean? You can't just and I'm not sure if Axl has grown. I think he has to a degree, but there's a lot more to go. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think Yeah, it's interesting how you bring up Trump, because something that Guns N' Roses was known for was sort of inciting arguably riots at their
show. Yes. Like, and like, I again, there's some more research for people. Just type in Axl Rose like stage meltdowns, and there's times where he literally, it usually happens during the song Rocket Queen, and we'll come back to Rocket Queen hopefully in the future, because that's also a controversial song. But like, what happens in Rocket Queen is a big old bridge where there's just a lot of music playing for a bit, and Axel will find someone being rude in the crowd, and he will literally like, not, I say dive off stage, right? And I don't mean that, oh, he steps down. No, he literally launches himself like a fish into water into the crowd and starts beating people up. And it's like, that you can't do that. And
yeah.
As he's been arrested after tons of shows as well. And and there's so many times where someone's done something in the crowd and he's just literally just thrown the mic on the floor and walked away. And that's the end of the show. And that's it. They're doing like a live recording, goes, no, I'm done, and just leaves. And yeah, and that's true diva behavior as well. It's unmitigated diva behavior, and he does do a lot of the trouble himself. I don't think the rest of the band do it, but he definitely he's very temperamental for sure.
Yeah, the really interesting thing with rock music is it wasn't born out of toxic masculinity, but it took on, obviously, from like the 1970s onward, This sort of machismo that, you know, sometimes it's an act. And in the case of Axl Rose, it's very real, I would say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the funny thing also about Guns N' Roses is, surprisingly, for all of their debauched behavior and the drama, in the late 80s, as early as their first album, they were already sort of self-aware about the fact that they didn't want people to take their music at face value. Like, I was reading, I think, a Spin interview with them, and they were talking to Slash, and he was like, I don't want kids to think that this is real. It's not real. We're joking around. We're doing these like fake characters. And I thought that was really surprising, but then at the same time, they're like bragging about how many drugs they're doing and everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think a part of the charm, particularly with Appetite for Destruction, there is that element of it's, I don't know, I always get a little bit skeptical when people say that it's a joke, you know what I mean? Because like, I think that's such an easy label to put on it. And it really annoys me when politicians or any public figure say, oh, it was just a joke. It's like, well, as a stand-up comedian, that was not intended as a joke. You know what I mean? Like, you didn't reflect in that way. And if it isn't clear that it's a punchline, people are going to take it the wrong way. And I don't know. I just kind of feel that it's an easy defense. But also, at the same time, you know, like, I can kind of see that Appetite for Destruction, it is very big. It's very grim. But also, I actually think that Appetite for Destruction does reflect their lives. You know, a lot of the lyrics were born from their real lives, and a lot of the lyrics they put into their work happen from their real life. For example, My Michelle, that's a real life story about this girl who went through like a lot of hardships and ended up doing drugs and kind of wasting her life away. And and also, more innocuously, there's stuff like when Axl and band went to New York, there's this man, this old elderly man, just shouting, "Welcome to the jungle, you're gonna die," and then they put that into the lyrics. And the same with Sweet Child of Mine, where they were in the recording booth, and they go like, you know, this song is good, but it just needs a little bit more over the after the solo. And Axl was like, oh, where do we go now, hey? Where do we go now? And I go, well, we put that in. And he goes,
wow.
Where do we go now? So I do think that I'm not saying it is their real life, but it's certainly real life things did make their music. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, the other thing is, if you look up the court filings of Erin Everly when she sued him for domestic abuse, it does seem like a lot of the terrible things he's said about women were kind of literal. So it's
and also on top of that, like there's a lot of songs which he wrote about women. And let me use this thing, for example. He did a song called Right Next Door to Hell on Use Your Illusion 1. And A lot of the songs off that album are like real life things. Basically, he's saying in that song, "Oh, I live next door to a psycho," but he literally threw wine bottles at this at the neighbor. So I think, ironically, he's writing it about himself. If you know what I mean, like he is the hell, but he doesn't realize that. And there's another song on "Use Your Illusion" where he's basically having a go at the press, who is having a go at him. So it is all born from real life stuff. You know, it's stuff which is his real life.
Yeah, he had a very antagonistic relationship with the press, which I don't appreciate in a celebrity. He wanted to have every member of the press who covered one of their tours sign a waiver saying that Guns N' Roses got to approve what they wrote before it was published.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's absurd. Yeah. You know, like between that and the riots, it is funny that he has the gall to now call out Donald Trump. It's like,
yeah, absolutely. Like
the literal exact same things as him. Like that really bothers me when people are like that with the press. But he reminds me, there's a lot of famous divas who he does remind me of. And with the press stuff this week, have you been following everything with Lana Del Rey this week?
I haven't actually. Could you?
So she is very antagonistic towards the press. And I say that as a fan of her music. She often targets journalists on Twitter, which is not so innocuous when you have a gigantic stan army that's ready to do your bidding. Like she has millions of people who literally have fan accounts dedicated to her. And when she says this journalist is bad, they harass that person. So it's happened before, and it happened this week because she gave an interview with BBC One and she said, you know, "I don't think Donald Trump realized he was inciting a riot. I think he's just that crazy of a person." She didn't say crazy. She said he's such a narcissist that to him, it didn't seem like he was inciting violence. So someone at Complex reported what she said. And the headline was like, "Lana Del Rey doesn't think Trump meant to incite riot," which is what she said. And she flipped out on Twitter and she posted this long video to Instagram where she talks about how much she dislikes the press. And she sort of threatens Complex. And she's like, "I thought we had a good relationship. Like, I've given you exclusives in the past." And she's sort of implying that she's not going to give them exclusives anymore. And it's just, I don't know. It reminded me of Axl Rose sitting and saying, "You're not allowed to publish anything that I haven't approved."
Yeah, and there's definitely a control complex there as well. Like, he regularly would do stuff, inappropriate stuff on those tours. Not necessarily, like, I mean, he would literally do band admin on stage. So he would call out other people on stage. For example, with Slash, it was like, "Oh, well, you know, I think we need to get rid of the real life Mr. Brownstone," a song about heroin abuse. And he was like, "Oh, you guys are doing too many drugs." And he's having to go with the rest of the band in front of a live show. And that's so crazy. Imagine, that's such, poor, it's unprofessional and just kind of like, that's diva behavior as well. Like it's very, I don't think you know what you're going to get with Axl on every night of the tour.
Yeah. I think maybe when you're a musician and you're so good at writing songs, and you are heavily financially awarded for it and vast, vast amounts of people are worshiping you, you probably start to have no patience for anyone around you having autonomy in a way that you don't agree with. And I guess that's unfortunate. Like you need some no people around to tell you that you can't be that way. But I guess it's funny how he would be late for his shows all the time and he would talk about it in interviews and he would not apologize for it. And there was one interview with Rolling Stone where he said, "If people don't want to stay late, if they have to work in the morning, they shouldn't come to my shows."
It's just so unreasonable, isn't it? It's kind of like I find people who think like that that they have such a lack of perception about how other people live their lives. It's kind of like today, I'm not sure if we're allowed to say anything political, so feel free to edit this out, but there's a Tory MP talking about the school dinner situations with the kids, and they're like, "Well, you know, it's only lunch, doesn't matter if you don't have that." I was like, these kids aren't, that's the only meal they're getting, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She can't see that they're not getting breakfast or dinner either, you know what I mean? Like, it's there's just a lack of perception in life, and that's definitely what Axl has as well. But also, I have to say, one of my favourite instances of Axl being late, even worse than him missing the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2012, which he was too late to. But
was he more... like being inducted and he missed it?
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
God,
I'm not sure. I think he made it at the very end, but there's definitely a picture of him with the rest of the band. But he definitely was very, very noticeably very late. But the worst one in 1991, he was about 3 hours late to a show. Right now, what do you think Axl's going to be doing this time? What do you think is so important of his time that what do you think he's doing?
I don't know, torturing his neighbor or something.
Not quite. In fact, this is a bit of a curveball here. He said he was too busy watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2: The Secret of the Ooze, which I think is the perfect reason to be late for a gig.
Wow, that is so insane. Oh my god. That's funny, because when he talks about it in interviews, he makes it like he's such a perfectionist that if he's not in the right mindset, that's why he's late. But it's like, no, that's not it. It's just because you don't care about other people's time.
Well, I kind of think he just has tantrums a lot. I think one time it's not just gigs, it's also recording days. Like he signed with Geffen Records, and he one day, I think for Chinese Democracy, he misplaced his contact lenses, stormed out of his home, believing someone wanted he couldn't read the contract properly, so he was like, "Well, I'm just going to go home then." He's like, and he just got drunk at a Whiskey Go Go, and it's like, well, that's probably not the most fitting use of your time, to be fair. But he's a very short fuse.
In Rolling Stone, in one of the interviews, they mention it was in the late 80s, so they still called it manic depressive. They said he was diagnosed manic depressive and that he was taking lithium. And I thought that was really interesting, because you didn't really hear about famous people's mental health stuff back then, right?
Absolutely. And if he didn't have, this is what I meant earlier about like having not just a trauma from the past, but also if he's dealing with ups and downs in his day-to-day life, that's going to affect his how he's on stage, how he behaves, and that kind of, it to be honest, that really I don't mean to tar with a massive brush here, but it makes a lot of sense of his behaviors and actions, you know. Like, and Matt, I don't think it's, maybe he's such a live wire because it's mental health issues. Because I think any person who wasn't dealing with bipolar, for them to jump off stage and punch people and get them tricked out and then leave the show, I think that's very, very rare and very, very very, very unlikely to happen. But if it's a bipolar, then again, it's not exactly, not say every person bipolar does this, but it makes more sense. It gives more credence why he might be doing that. And it makes more sense. And I think it's more, you can see why he might be doing that more.
It also made me draw a lot of parallels in my head about the behavior, parallels between him and Kanye West with some of the things that Kanye has said and everything. So that definitely made me look at him differently from like a more, probably more sympathetic perspective, just to know that he was like dealing with that. And I think it's really cool that he has been open about that, and he's been open about seeking treatment since the late 80s, and no one else was talking about that for the longest time. So I think there was probably a lot of like young guys who were reading every single interview with him and devouring it, who kind of said, oh, maybe I can sort of figure this stuff out for myself too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hopefully that I hope that people got the help they needed from Axl Rose being open in that way. But hopefully that people don't see, hopefully people see that his Axl for his positive aspects and his negative aspects, and are able to filter between the two. Do you know what I mean? Like, I worry that some people listen to Appetite Destruction and love it for the wrong reasons. And this isn't exactly the most positive note in the world, but as I mentioned, I saw Guns N' Roses live at Download in 2018. I went for the full weekend. So on the Friday night, it was Avenged Sevenfold headlining. Saturday night, Guns N' Roses. Then Sunday night, it was Ozzy Osbourne. And during the festival, there's always there are always day tickets. So the vibe of the festival changes ever so slightly during the headliners, because that's what pretty much the reason why people come, the day tickets come in, and they act differently from the whole festival. The rest of the festival is like this giant community. We're all there. We're out there every year. But the day ticketers come in, and they... And the thing is with Guns N' Roses fans, and this is the first time I saw it at a gig when I was old enough to know what's acceptable. And what's not acceptable is that I saw there was a girl on someone's shoulders, and I saw a group of like men just start groping her, and I was and no one else batted an eyelid, but I had to go and say pack it in and stop it, and I had to make sure she was okay. But it was like it made me so angry.
Oh my god, that must have been scary.
It was, but I was also. I also didn't want to step by and not do anything, if you know what I mean, because I hate confrontation. I'm not a fighter, but also it's arguable that Guns N' Roses attract that kind of mentality. Hopefully it isn't a boys club, and I'm sure not everyone who listens to it, like myself, is part of that boys club, but also it's kind of like, it's weird that for the one day that happened, it was Guns N' Roses, and it was a Saturday night, so you might have just had people just being more drunk or larry than usual, but it's a coincidence, which I don't think it's a coincidence. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, if it makes you feel better, and if it makes the Guns N' Roses fandom feel better, when I was younger, going to Warped Tour and stuff, I would get groped all the time. And I didn't even know that I was allowed to be mad about it at the time. In the last probably 10, 15 years was when I started to realize just because you're at a music festival doesn't mean people can grope you.
Yeah. And I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. It's nothing, I've never done anything like that in my life, and nor would I, thankfully so. But in my head, when I first went to festivals, there was a mindset in my head that, since I'm at a festival, a teenage boy, and bear in mind, I've never been kissed at this point. I was like, I assumed that girls would want to get off of me. And I don't know where it came from, but in my head, it wasn't a good thing to grope people, but it was like, it wasn't condemned, you know what I mean? There was there's a lad mentality there. Again, I never did it, and I absolutely condemn people who do, but I'm saying I acknowledge there was a filter down process where people have, done that, you know what I mean? Or seeing people do it, and I'm not sure where that comes from, but there's definitely a misogyny and in rock music. But however, I do think it's improving, and definitely. Maybe there's, and particularly with modern punk, as I mentioned earlier, one of my favorite artists is someone called Jeff Rosenstock, and in his live album, and with many many punk musicians these days, Jeff starts off his shows by he does a song. Then before the second song, he's very much like, all right, just to clarify in here, sometimes people think it's okay to grope people, and it's absolutely not. And what he does, he goes, if you're at risk or you feel like you might be in danger, just taps. I want you to give a cheer if you are there to support people. And the whole room cheers. Everyone's like, and it goes, that's the people who will support you. Just tap someone on the shoulder and can sort you out and get that person out of there. And it's really empowering, because it's kind of like, because punk's meant to be for everyone. It's meant to be for all that. And people are highlighting it as well. And I think listening to that really, it makes me feel good, because it feels like it's going in the right direction. It feels like I feel validated in that way as well. I feel like it's a good thing, you know. And the sad thing is that a lot of people are surprised when I say that, because it should happen anyway, but yeah, I mean, it's but I'm glad that people are actively calling it out as well. And this is on the live album as well, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, definitely. Something else crazy is how much money they made. In the first 4 years, their first 4 years as a band, they made $52 million, which is that's just insane. Completely unheard of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, as you say, that's the reason why Axl probably has that autonomy, because he's like, well, I don't need to do this. I'm brilliant as it is. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely bang on right there.
But he has said, which surprised me, that Bohemian Rhapsody, Queen is his favorite band, he said, and he worships Freddie Mercury. And it's really interesting, because I would never have put that together ever. I would never think that that was his gold standard. But I guess when you look at the way that he behaved in the band, it sort of did seem like he considered himself to be the leader. But did the other guys consider him to be the leader, or were they all just more interested in being equals?
Well, again, I think it's a hard one to determine, because I think, especially before Appetite for Destruction, I remember the band manager talking about different members of the band, and I remember a quote from the band manager about Slash saying Slash was too drunk or too intoxicated and too lacking of management in the band that he couldn't even run a bath. That was the joke he said. He couldn't even run a bath. So I kind of feel that a lot of them were just kind of there for different reasons, you know what I mean? And I feel Axel probably took a lead. I think Axel, because of his personality, probably, again, this is purely speculative, but I think he probably would have taken more of a charge in that, do you know what I mean? And he took a charge with a lot of the things. And that, but yeah, a lot of other people started, I don't think they were necessarily being equals. I think they were all just kind of, going from day to day, if you know what I mean. They were very, very high, very drunk, and very eventful, I would say.
Yeah, apparently he actually didn't do that much substance abuse, according to a couple of the things I read. Like, they had this image, obviously, because of Slash and because of Duff McKagan, but apparently Axel wasn't really doing much, which is interesting because it's similar to Mick Jagger. Like, he never really did drugs either, even though the rest of them were doing, like, everything. But I actually interviewed Duff McKagan once, and I completely,
really?
Yeah, I forgot that I did that. And I was doing research for this, and I saw his name, and I was like, wait, I interviewed that guy. So I talked to him a few years ago, and he told me this story, because I was like, you have to tell me at least one crazy story from the road and from your days in Guns N' Roses. And he told me about this time when recently he met Elton John at a concert or something, and he was like, hi, I'm Duff. And Elton John was like, no, we've met before. And he was like, what do you mean? And Elton John told him that when Guns N' Roses played at Wembley Stadium, Duff McKagan was so drunk and messed up that he was falling all over the place backstage. Elton John was the only person near him, and he like picked him up and like hoisted him onto the stage, and he was like, dude, you have to perform, like, get on the stage. So Duff got on and he did all of his songs perfectly, and then as soon as he was done, he just fell off the stage again, and Elton John like brought him to his room. And he was like, oh my god, I have no recollection of that whatsoever.
Oh my god. And you know what, like, my inner fanboy is cheered very loudly, like, oh my god, you met Duff McKagan, oh my god. Like, I felt could you, I know you're a journalist and it probably breached your professionalism, but could you send a message from me just saying, I love you? Yeah, that's all you have to say. Okay, that's all you have to say.
I don't think I have his email address. He was so cool, though. He was one of the coolest celebrities that I've interviewed, for sure. Just so cool, so approachable. And the whole interview, he talked all about his daughter's band and about all of the young musicians that he's into. It was really cool because he didn't dwell on the past at all. Mm-hmm. He was like, here's who I'm into. He's a huge fan of Charlie XCX, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he was awesome.
And I actually remember seeing Duff perform with his band Loaded at Download, and a long time ago, but it was I actually think we talked about redemptive arcs earlier, and I think Duff and Slash both had theirs. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, because I think they were both really young and were doing their thing, but they both went on to do really, really wonderful things, particularly Slash. I think Slash has really gotten his act together, and like from 2010 onwards, he has done phenomenal music, and he's putting out albums. He's working with Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, and it's really great music. And I think he needed that to kind of have it back in to get his groove back. And I think I think they all had that, they all had their own kind of arcs and stuff like that, and obviously Velvet Revolver, Slash did really well from that as well. And there was but I think Slash needed that thing for himself. I think he needed that thing for himself to do that.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting how it seems like you have to hit when you're in your early 20s, or else you're just never gonna hit. And then even if you keep making music for the rest of your life, it's probably never gonna hit like that did. Why do you think that is?
You know what? It's a really interesting question. And I think I've been looking at a lot of bands recently doing research, and particularly with particularly with a lot of 80s metal bands, and also the trend happens with indie bands in the 2000s. So that there's one amazing album, a second album which is pretty good, and they're off the radar forever. It's I call it, when I was a teenager, I call it indie band syndrome, and they basically two albums are out, and I'm not sure. Maybe people lose interest. There's also an oversaturation as well, so people are kind of move on to new things, and a lot of things kind of go through a fad. And I'm not sure what it is. And maybe it's just the music industry. Maybe it's people just turning their backs on it. We don't get to see the inner machinations of how it all works, but the time and place is right, and then they kind of go their own separate ways. But I don't know, I think there's also a magic with a first album. I think the debut album for anyone is always really special. It has that, this is me just thinking from all my research. I kind of think that with a first album, first and second album, I feel that the first album has no one messing around with it, and I think as soon as you get more A&R and record labels messing around with it, I'm a hardcore punk, by the way. I love people like Jeff Rosenstock and AJJ, people who like modern punk is really awesome because they just do it in the bedrooms and it's wonderful. I think the less people messing around with it, that it's more like just it's more the authentic sound. It's not meant to be more marketable. It's not meant to be. It's not overthought. It's kind of and that's the issue which Axl had with Chinese Democracy. It was too overthought. In case anyone doesn't know what Chinese Democracy is, it was an album which Axl worked on for 12 years. He recorded it and re-recorded it 15 times, and it was an absolute car crash. Initially it came out as a car crash. It wasn't as bad as everyone made out, but it was not good. It wasn't good in any particular way, and it was a lot of controversy came from that album as well. But yeah, I feel that to answer your question, the first album is always it has less people. It's more the most authentic band you can ever be. I also find with comedy as well. I think Brendan Burns once said it in an interview with Richard Herring, saying that the first time you do a gig is actually the most authentic you are ever. I'm not sure Yeah, I know. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I kind of feel that there's an element there where you're. I don't know. I kind of feel that with and maybe there's less inhibitions when you try it for the first time. I don't know. I think I am more myself now than I was back then. But I don't know. Yeah,
I think I had more inhibitions when I first started. Do you know what I think it might be with? Because as you're saying all this, I was thinking about people who have been good over the course of many, many albums. And I would say the Beatles would fall into that. The Beach Boys until things went off the rails. The Rolling Stones for most of their career. And that, like you said, was a time when the music industry was less oversaturated. So there was less of a thing where everyone's striving to get to the top. And also solo artists a lot of the time have more luck over the course of 10, 20 years. So maybe it's because today with bands, probably from the mid 80s onward, you have to be so much better to even get noticed. And you have to trim the fat for so long until you even get to that debut album. You know how it is with comedy. Every time you listen to a spot that you've done, you're trimming the fat, you're trimming what didn't work. And then if you have to do the same thing without the same amount of time to prepare, it's not going to be as good. So maybe also I think with bands, they start to hate each other after a while because I think fame probably changes everyone. How could it not? And then after the first one or two albums, they're just like, oh my God, I got to get away from these guys.
And particularly with the Beatles as well, they did so many albums in the space of 10 years or 7 years, and they were doing nearly to a year, essentially. And it was really rapid. And so they kind of canned that magic right there. But also, yeah, as you say, like, I think people, if you're working with that person so long and you all have different ideas how you want to get stuff across, it's going to be difficult as well. Like, particularly with Guns N' Roses, I think that they all had kind of different directions as well. Mm-hmm. And they definitely had different ways of doing things as well.
Also, they were sort of the last gasp of hair metal. They weren't hair metal, but they were reminiscent of it, and they were sort of an offshoot of that genre, right? Mm-hmm. I would say. And yeah. I read this really interesting thing in one of the Rolling Stone stories about them, and it said it was over for Guns N' Roses as soon as Nirvana released Nevermind in the mm-hmm. autumn of 1991. So that was obviously a culture shift. The minute that Nirvana hit the scene, it was like, you know, and it said this was revenge for Kurt Cobain, who had been viciously running down Axl at Nirvana gigs. And Kurt Cobain said, "We come from small towns." This is really interesting because it's about toxic masculinity. He said, "We come from small towns and we've been surrounded by a lot of sexism and racism, but our internal struggles are pretty different. I feel like I've allowed myself to open my mind a lot more to a lot more things than he has. His role has been played for years. Ever since the beginning of rock and roll, there's been an Axl Rose, and it's just totally boring to me." Which, like, yeah. Talk about diva. That is, like, world-class diva shade from Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, and, like, I think Kurt Cobain and Axl have had a lot of collisions in their time. And you're absolutely right. Just to sum up that, what you were saying as well, like, I've been doing research for other about that time period for hair metal, coincidentally. And yeah, so Guns N' Roses, as you say, got that a couple of albums in, but as soon as Nevermind came along, it kind of was a massive grunge explosion. And like people like Skid Row, for example, who are not a massive hair metal band, they prefer glam metal because hair metal is used as a derogative term. It's not a massive derogative term, but yeah, they had to push all their albums back about 5-10 years just so that people might try. So they tried to hope for resurgence in it.
Wow.
But yeah, grunge took over, and it was bands like Soundgarden and Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains kind of dominate the scenes as well as Nirvana as well. Guns N' Roses asked Nirvana to support them on tour, and they just said no thanks because quite homophobic, and which I think is really awesome from Kurt Cobain. But also,
Who was doing that back? What like straight man who wanted to be famous was sticking up for gay people back in the late 80s, early 90s? Like that really is amazing that Kurt Cobain did that.
And I think it was nice as well. And I also did research. There's also another story to do with Nirvana and Kurt Cobain. And I'm not quite sure how it came about, but Courtney Love asked Rose if he'd like to be Francis Bean. Love asked Rose if he'd like to be Francis Bean's godfather. Axl told Kurt to tell his B word to shut up and challenge Kurt to a fight.
Jesus.
Like, but his reaction for about, I'm gonna say 15 years was, "Say something to me and I'll fight you." That's essentially what it was, and it
insane.
Would be to anyone. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And in fact, he hated, obviously later on in his career, he was doing Guns N' Roses, which was just himself and lots of random people on stage. I actually saw him in Leeds 2010 or 11 headlining, and with this kind of weird Chinese democracy band as well. It was
But the guy with the KFC bucket on his head.
Yes, Buckethead. But actually Buckethead wasn't there. He actually got fired from the band at that point. Buckethead used to have chicken coops in the Chinese Democracy studios as well, amongst other things as well. And inside the chicken coops, he would be streaming pornography, quite disturbing pornography, for 24 hours a day. That's the kind of thing that went on to that album. But all of these are very weird, and always, I think they all stem from the same place. You know what I mean? It's a fantasy, the way that they live their lives. And maybe, you know, they're saying that it is a fantasy, don't believe in it, but that's also their lives. They are living this weird, weird kind of rock fantasy. And I think it's very different from I guess what idol with Axel, I think what you said earlier about Queen, about how Axel loved Queen, I think in his head he thinks if he spends time, as much time and money on the album, it'll make it good, but he also lost a lot of the soul there as well. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, that's the thing with music and being a musician. Obviously, I'm not a musician, so I don't know that much about it. But it seems if you don't hit with your genre and your skill set at the exact right time in music history, you're going to be either nobody, or if you hit at the right time, you're going to be enormous. So it's like, if you did hit the way that Guns N' Roses hit, and then you stop hitting, it's kind of like, what do you do? Like, do you go into a new genre? Do you reinvent yourself? Or do you try to keep doing the same thing but bigger? And yeah, I just can't imagine the stress of having to live up to that kind of past success, I guess.
It's so hard being a stand-up comedian, like, because so many people are asking me, Matt, when's your next show? I was like, oh, I can't do it right now. But it's very, very, you know, a lot of people, up to 5 people have asked me in the last year. So, you know what I mean? It's going well for me, Molly. Do you reckon after this podcast, do you reckon I should start to try and get, you know, it's been a hard year for all comedians in the last year. Do you reckon I should start living a bit like Axl Rose to try and be a bit more, should you reckon that'll get my career on track? Do you reckon that?
Right, like just be as crazy as possible. I mean, who knows?
I'll be honest, I don't think it really fits in my wheelhouse. I think I'm too nice to be Axl Rose. But who knows? I might trick a wine bottle at someone and hope for the best. So
yeah, I think he was just like a live wire. He was like an exposed nerve. That's what it seems like when you read about the way that he was and the things that all of his ex-girlfriends have said about him, which he is going on to my list, which I have a list of male creatives who were supported by a woman earlier in their careers and mm-hmm. were never called out for it or called a gold digger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are so many. Like Axl Rose and Kurt Cobain have that in common. They both mm-hmm. had a hometown girlfriend who was working a crappy part-time job and supporting them while they figured out how to be a musician. And then when they got famous, they like never spoke to them again.
Yeah, that's such a common thing. Yeah. And the way that you just mentioned that has brought so many examples to my mind. But yeah, absolutely happens. Yeah.
And yeah, it's a big thing in music. But he had a really like great, interesting dating history. He had that hometown girlfriend. He had Erin Everly, who was in the Sweet Child of Mine video, who sued mm-hmm. him. And he had Stephanie Seymour, which I had no idea. I know who Stephanie Seymour is because one of my previous jobs was at the New York Observer, and we wrote a lot about like New York society. And she now is married to a billionaire, and she has these sons with him named Peter Brandt and Harry Brandt, and they're these dandies who dress really flamboyantly. They kind of were controversial because there was a photo shoot that went viral of Stephanie Seymour and her son like kissing and him touching her boob, and then he came out and he was like, I'm gay, don't worry, like that was just a photo shoot. And it's just like, okay. She was a supermodel in the late 80s early 90s, but
I've got to delete some pictures of me and my mom. Sorry.
No, like crazy.
Sorry, just joking.
He dated her and I had no idea. And they had a really serious relationship. And they said in a lot of these stories about him that part of the reason why he went into Howard Hughes mode and sort of locked himself up for 10 years was because of the relationship with Stephanie not working out. He considered her his ideal woman. I mean, this is obviously also an excuse to like blame a woman for your problems, but he said she was an ideal woman and he was very upset that they broke up and that she married this billionaire, and like that was part of the reason why he never wanted to come outside again.
From this conversation, I kind of think that Axl Rose is like the real life BoJack Horseman. Do you know what I mean? We kind of want him to be good, but he also keeps on messing it up for himself consistently.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like
it really does.
Yeah. I really want Axl to kind of have his, I want him to have his heyday. I want him to kind of have that arc. I was like, you know what? Yeah, he's kind of like, he's gone full circle. Well, not full circle. Definitely not full circle, but just a straight line, please. But
yeah,
like
we want
upward trajectory, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what else I was thinking about him? He is obviously a consummate rock star because of all of these things we've talked about, you know, the being late for shows, being sort of toxic masculinity and all this stuff. But I also feel like if rock wasn't his genre, he's kind of just a showman in general. Like if he tried pop or if he even was like the first Vanilla Ice, he probably also would have succeeded. I feel like he's right.
Yeah. Cause I kind of, in a weird way, I think he is charming. Do you know what I mean? Like, is that right? No. Is he charming? No. He's definitely, as you said, he's a live wire. And I think that if you tap that in the right way, I think you can have a really good pop star, or you could have a, you know, you could have, I think he's creative. He's got a talent. He has talent. And I just
charisma.
Think that, yeah, absolutely. You know what? I think you're right. He has charisma, but I don't think he's charming. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I think there's a very nuance there. You know what I mean? And I think he has the ability to write amazing and wonderful songs, particularly on Use Your Illusion. Like, the more power ballady songs are really phenomenal and touching and wonderful. Mm. And yeah, it's all it. That album, well, the highlights of that album really show what kind of wonderful music Guns N' Roses can make, and particularly like it's hard to describe, but I think the reason why I love Guns N' Roses is that particularly with Appetite for Destruction, for the 11 and a half tracks, is that the whole band basically were getting drunk and doing very disturbing acts and having inappropriate relationships with people and kind of discarding them and treating them in a really bad way. But that's for the full album. But then at the very end, at the Rocket Queen, there's the whole after the bridge and the solo, there's a snap. And what happens, and there's actually a sliver that the rest of the song is basically like, you know what, like, it doesn't matter if we're not going to be here together, I'll always be there for you, I'll always be a friend. And from a whole album of toxic masculinity, there's a bit at the end that goes, you know what, at the end, it doesn't matter about the rest of that, I'm there for you as a friend. You know what I mean? I think, and there's, that's why I think there's redemption there, because like, even through all the other stuff there is that sliver of humanity, and I think that's still there, and it's growing.
That is a great note to end on, I would say. I think that the thing we forget a lot of the time about people who are full of rage is it's often an outgrowth of sensitivity, and I think that's the case with him. I think he's just like so wounded, and I know I hated on him for this in the beginning of always playing a victim, but you know, that's real.
Yeah.
So sure. Matt, tell us a little bit about your podcast before we wrap it up.
Yes. Well, I do, my main podcast is called Castable. It's where I get famous people to pitch their dream music festival. It's we're doing the third series very soon. So please go and check it out. It's available on Apple and Spotify. And basically if you like, a little bit of comedy, but also a deep dive into some music as well. It's not a snob podcast. So if you like music, but you don't know that much about it, don't worry about it. It's all there for fun as well. So it's been a really fun project, which I've really loved. And we should have you on soon, Molly. It'd be great to have you.
Oh, I would love to. Is Guns N' Roses in your music festival, dream music festival?
It's hard because it's hard to pitch because I've actually seen Guns N' Roses live and I think that was perfect for me. I'm not sure if I was to see him again, I'm not sure if they'll be in my lineup because I would like to see people I haven't seen before. Mm. But if it's people I have seen, they're pretty good Saturday night headliners. So they're pretty wonderful. So but you know, in Castable, we have a set of rules, and well, the rules are there aren't really any rules. So you can have stipulations on people. So, for example, one of the ideas of the fest, you could have the Smiths, but Morrissey has to not be a racist. That's the stipulations you could have. You know what I mean? Like, so I think my stipulation would be that Guns N' Roses original lineup, but everyone's a top lad. You know what I mean? Everyone's really nice. They kind of right all the wrongs. They say, hey. They burn One in a Million on stage. I don't know how you burn a song, but they do it, and that's what happens. And it's all nice, and everyone hugs each other at the end. That's what I want.
That sounds beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for coming on Diva Behavior.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Some people think Diva's
a diva for you. Would you say, are you one?
I never said that.
Diva behavior.
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Of course, I don't trust you.
Diva behavior, the podcast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.